Now, last week, we looked at the tracing of the lineage of descent from Adam and Eve that Moses gave us here in the scriptures. And it looks something like this. You have this in your handout. This is fall number 29. This is a line of descent from Adam and Eve down to the flood. He could have taken it further, and we do get some more information later on, but this is what he gave us here so far. And in this line of descent, there's sort of two parallel lines that differ significantly. On the left, we have the line of descent from what the Lord calls the Satan seed in the earlier part of Genesis. And those are the guys who essentially disobeyed God, blew him off, didn't care to follow him. In fact, they actually physically moved away from him, physically as well as spiritually, didn't really want anything to do with him. And then the line on the right represents the seed of Eve. That would be the godly line. And you can see those people there. At Enosh, there in the third generation, scriptures say that people actually started calling on the name of the Lord in groups, in mass, so that they started worshiping together as a group of people. Now, as you go down through those two lines, by the time you get down to the flood, something has happened to those two distinctly different lines of descent. They've meshed together, and they've been corrupted. The godless line on the left has corrupted the godly line on the right. Now, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15:33, that don't be deceived. Evil companions will corrupt good morals. The general principle is that evil will corrupt good. Drop that white glove in a mud puddle, and the mud puddle doesn't become clean. The white glove gets muddy. Evil will corrupt good. That's the normal thing. So it shouldn't just shock us that there is corruption between the two lines as they meshed, because that's the norm. But what is shocking is the extent of that corruption. If you think back to our own history from about early 1600s to now, say roughly 400 years, we grew to a little over 300 million people, right? 400 years, population growth a little over 300 million. The flood will occur about 1600 years after Adam and Eve. A little more than that. If we grew 300 million in 400 years, what do you think the world did in 1600 years? Four times as long. And their death rate there was practically zero. Everybody's living to be 1,000 years old almost. So if we grew 300 million plus in 400 years, in 1600 years, what do you think the world's population would have been at the time of the flood? Who knows, but it's a big number. It could easily be a few billion. Could be on the order of what we have today even. So when you look at the corruption of those two lines of descent, by the time you get down to generation 10, which was when the flood occurred, everybody on the planet had been corrupted, with the exception of eight people. That is staggering. The fact that the lines would corrupt is one thing, but the fact that the extent of it was everybody except eight people. Let's say there's 2 billion people. Who knows? Two, four, one, I don't know how many. Everybody except Noah and his family was corrupted and thoroughly corrupted. The way God described it was that their thinking was at all times, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And those are some absolutes in there that, again, just make grasping the extent of this corruption very difficult. So that by the time the flood came, eight whole people out of maybe a few billion were righteous. That's hard to imagine, isn't it? Because we live in an era in which the Holy Spirit indwells the church. He lives on this earth in the hearts of believers, and he restrains sin. So we don't see such a deterioration like they did in our lifetime because we live in a different era. So it's hard for us to grasp this. But if you can kind of halfway imagine that when the rapture occurs and the Holy Spirit changes his ministry, the church leaves the planet and he no longer restrains sin through the church, you can imagine what in the world this world is going to be like and how fast it will deteriorate. It will be good that we're not here. It will be very good that we're not here. So the whole world was corrupted by the 10th generation, and God says, I'm going to do a do-over. I'm going to wipe out humanity from off the face of the earth and start over. So he tells Noah and his family to build them an ark, a protective floating device, a boat. This little block of wood is cut to the same relative dimensions of the ark. See that? 3 by 5 by 30. That's what it looked like in relative dimensions there. And it would sit in the water probably about halfway up this side here. So you couldn't turn that thing over if you had to. Only God could turn it over. Waves wouldn't be able to tip it over. It had no hydrodynamic properties one way or the other. It's just a floating zoo is all it was ever intended to be. And it was. 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. About a four-story building high. And God said, build that, Noah. You ain't got anything else to do for the next 120 years. So you and them boys of yours, get out there and start whittling them trees down and build that monstrous boat, and they did. And it was for them and them alone. Verse 22 of chapter 6, thus Noah did according to all God had commanded him, so he did. God told Noah, hey, the reason I want you to do this, pal, is because it's going to rain. Noah says, rain? What's rain? They never had any. But Noah did what God told him to do. That's faith. Doing what God says, taking God at his word, regardless of any logic or scientific verification or any of that nonsense, he just did what God told him. Verse 1 of chapter 7, and the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the two animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female. Apparently some of these now were going to be used in sacrifice, and so there's more of some of them than others. Some are designated clean and some are designated unclean. It's rather arbitrary, but nevertheless, it's designated that way. And also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of the earth. For after seven more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I'll blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. So God says, all right, Noah, this 120 years is about over. Seven more days, it's going to happen. Get the animals in the ark. Get the food that you're going to need for the next year. You got a week to get that done, so get busy. And verse 5 of chapter 7. And Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. Noah was an obedient, faithful man. And his life illustrates the principle that obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings judgment, and he was obedient. Verse 6, Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. That's 1,656 years after Adam. So the flood occurred about 1,656 years after the creation and Adam. It's a do-over. And only Noah and his family now have been invited into this ark. So then Noah and his sons, I'm at verse 7 of chapter 7, and his wives and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood. And of clean animals and animals that are not clean and birds and everything that creeps on the ground, there went into the ark to Noah by twos, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. Now, he didn't have to go out here and shag them all down somewhere. They came to him. And they've got this big door built in the side of the thing, which is probably a ramp. And the animals then came up the ramp into the ark, and Noah and his family then displaced him into whatever little corrals and little rooms and whatnot that they had set up for him. So the last week before the flood came, and we'll talk about what that's about here in a minute, was consisted of loading these animals up and loading the food and everything. So they went into the ark by Noah, twos, male, female, said that. Verse 10, and it came about after the 7 days that the water of the flood came up on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, there's an interesting little implication there. On the 17th day of the month, the flood started. What day was the resurrection? Passover. 14th was the Good Friday, or the beginning of Passover. And on Sunday would have been the 17th. So the resurrection of our Lord occurred on the 17th day of the month. It's interesting here that on the 17th day of this month, this judgment took place as well. There's probably a relationship there, probably a parallel. If someone wanted to study it, if you could figure that all out. And on that day, all of the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. Now, to understand what's going on here, you got to kind of adjust your thinking a little bit from the word rain. The word rain is kind of a nondescript, not very descriptive of what's going on here. Remember, we talked about back in the creation on day two, God separated, this is page 25 in your handout, God separated the waters that were below from the waters that were above. So that there was this, the earth itself, the surface of the earth was watery, then there was this space, and then there was some more water, probably in the form of vapor. I don't think it would be like a river, but a dense form of water above the earth. So that this description here in verse 11 of chapter 7, the fountains of the great deep burst open. That is, some of this water came out of the earth down here below. The crust of the earth, it appears, was fractured in such a way that the water down below could come rushing up onto the surface. And with that, the floodgates of the sky were opened. All of this stuff up above here is somehow or another condensed down onto the planet as well. So this isn't a rain like you think a rain. This is a torrent of water coming from two sources, both of which would have tremendously destructive erosive properties, coming from within the earth itself and then collapsing down from above. Now, I've mentioned this to you before. If you take your little watering pot and you go out to your little plant that you got on the patio and you water with your watering pot gently, it can survive that, can't it? It can absorb that water and it's okay. But what if you take that big watering pot, take that spigot off and go whap, and just throw that water down onto that plant? Now what happens to it? It ain't there anymore, is it? You just wash it away. The erosive property of the water is too great. It's very, very destructive. And that's, I think, what we have going on here. We have water coming from within the earth's crust and collapsing down onto the earth from above at such a torrid rate that nobody can survive it. You can't grab onto a log somewhere and float through this thing. 40 days and 40 nights of this going on. People ain't ready. There's only one guy that's ready, and that's Noah and his family. He's got a vessel that is prepared for this. Nobody else does. And there's no way you could grab something and hang on for 40 days and 40 nights. You'd starve to death if you could. People can't survive this deluge, and it wasn't intended that they survive it. It was intended that it wiped them out, and it did. And so the rain fell on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. So the destructive nature of this thing is way beyond any form of rain that you know of. Now slide 32 has a chronological summary now of the flood. And the first section there that you can see is the 40 days and 40 nights. So whatever is happening here And we think it is a kind of a bifold whammy of the water in the atmosphere condensing down onto the earth in great rapid numbers and flooding up from the earth. That went on for 40 days and 40 nights. Now on the very same day, verse 13 of chapter 7, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wives and the three wives of his sons entered the ark. They and the very beast, every beast after their kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. So they went into the ark to Noah by twos of all flesh, in which was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded them, and the Lord closed it behind him. The Lord closed the door. I suspect the door was so big that Noah couldn't close it. It was probably just a big, huge ramp. And the Lord closed them in, and he is the protector of them and this ark. And the flood came upon the earth for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. So for 40 days and 40 nights, the water is just accumulating on the surface of the earth till eventually it floats the ark. And Noah and his family are then floating after this 40 days and 40 nights. And the water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. I think I skipped verse 19. And the water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. And the water prevailed 15 cubits higher, and the mountains were covered. Why does the water have to get 15 cubits, say about 23, 24 feet higher than the mountains? Remember, this thing is going to sit down in the water. It'll probably sit, with all the weight in, it'll probably sit to about a half of that 45 foot height. So it will sit down in the water a little ways, and so the mountains have to be covered by water by the amount of distance that this thing is going to sit in the water. So that's why I think it prevailed another 15 cubits above the mountain. So everywhere on the face of the earth now, everything is covered. This is not some local flood involving a few hundred people in some community somewhere. This ain't Houston. This is the entire earth. And the entire surface of the earth is now underwater. And there's one object that is alive. That's that ark and the people in it. Everybody else is dead. Can you imagine the amount of debris in the water? Plant life, animal life, human life. Probably not a pretty place for a while going on there. And all flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds, cattle, beasts, every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth, and all mankind. Of all that was on the dry land and in the nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, died. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah was left, together with those who were with him in the ark, and the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So between the 40 days of raining and another 110 days, water is still rising and not ebbing away at all. It's still covering everything and floating. So, 40 days of deluge, another 110 days of water continuing to rise and cover everything on the planet. It's hard to grasp something of this magnitude, isn't it? The geography is a difficult issue to grasp. The extent of the depravity of man is difficult to grasp. Difficult things to get our minds around because of the magnitude of them that's going on here. But it is judgment of mankind, and it was a worldwide judgment because of worldwide corruption. Kind of another little interesting summary of this same thing here in Psalms 104. It's another description of the same thing. How many Psalms are there, by the way? 150. How many did David write? About half. 150 psalms. The Jews organized them into five different song books. David wrote about half of those 150. In Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9, He established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. Thou didst cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At the sound of thy thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose and the valleys sank down. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. The place which thou didst establish for them, thou didst set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. So the psalmist is going to talk about the same sort of thing as what happened right here at the flood. The whole place is covered, and God is manipulating and redesigning the crust of the earth, the geological and topological profile of the earth, I think, is being redesigned and rebuilt here at this time. Now, God remembered, verse 1 of chapter 8, God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Now, to kind of reverse this process, God has brought this wind over the surface of the earth that is now going to bring this water vapor back up into the air, bring the water back up into the air as water vapor, and the hydrological cycle that we have now is being put into place. What we have now is primarily driven by the sun. The sun evaporates water from the oceans. It rises up and condenses, goes over land, and then it condenses more and rains back down onto the ground and runs back down to the oceans. That just keeps on going on, you know, in a cycle. That didn't happen before the flood. Remember, there was no rain. There were no clouds. They were in sort of a greenhouse type environment with the canopy blocking the sun's rays so that you don't get that kind of evaporation and so on. So the whole hydrological cycle of the planet is now different after the flood than it was before, or at least that's what it appears. And the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed. God shut that off. No more coming up from the earth and no more coming down from above, and the rain from the sky was restrained. And the water receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. So at the end of this 150 days here now, things are starting to change back around, and the water is decreasing again instead of continuing to build up. So the first 150 days were the worst. But that's now over. And on the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. This would be in up in Turkey, kind of western Turkey. There were mountains there, and that's where the ark came to rest. There's some of the mountain ranges up there are somewhere in a 14 to 17,000 feet range. And that's where God parked this thing. This was going to be where they would end up surviving the flood and disembarking, was from these mountain ranges there in Turkey. Now, there will be taller mountains. Well, there's our mascot going there. There's taller mountains around than these, but these is where God parked the ark, and we'll talk about them here in a second, too. So then it came about at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark, which he had made, and he sent out a raven, and it flew there, here and there, until the water was dried up from the earth. Now this raven that he sends out, first of all, is an unclean type of bird. It doesn't care what it eats. It doesn't care what it lands on. So it doesn't have a problem going out there and landing on some of this decaying plant and animal and human life is floating around out there somewhere. So it just stays gone. It's in raven heaven, man. There's all kinds of dead stuff out there for it to eat. And then he sends out a dove, verse 8, to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, so she returned to him and to the ark. The water was on the surface of the earth, and he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark to himself. Now he sends this dove out. This would be about right in through here. And the dove, unlike the raven, it didn't want to land on that yuck. So it can't find it a good place to land, and so it comes back to the ark. So Noah knows that not much out there to sustain life just yet. So he brings the ark back in. By the way, doves mate for life. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. If you kill a dove, if you hunt and you kill a dove, be sure and kill the other one too. Otherwise, you've destroyed a dove family. They mate for life. very gentle birds. It's a little different, a lot different than the raven. So this one comes back. Verse 10, so he waited another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out. And a dove came to him toward evening, and behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water had abated from the earth. So the second cycle with the dove tells him now that water's abated enough, things are starting to sprout, there's a little bit of something out there, a little bit of vegetation, and the dove found a piece of it and brought it back to him. So he's kind of getting a sample of what's out there using this dove as the indicator. So then he waited another 7 days and sent the dove out again, and she did not return to him again. So he finally, at that point in time, about right in through here, he concludes that, hey, there's enough out there now, enough growing, that this dove thinks it can live. And so we're starting to get a cycle now of life coming back on the earth following this flood. Verse 13, chapter 8. Now it came about in the 601st year, that's 1 year later, remember 600 when this happened, 1 year later, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Then Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. So a year later, now, the earth is starting to be in good enough shape that people can actually live on it again. And he has concluded that it's dried up. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. So the whole thing took about a year and a little bit. So God tells Noah in verse 15, go out of the ark, verse 16, you and your wife, your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that's with you, birds, animals, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So the whole idea, once again, was to populate the earth again, animals and plants and people. So Noah went out, his sons and his wives and his sons' wives with him. That's got to take a little bit of courage, just that, doesn't it? In that new environment that he was in, that ark was a pretty handy place to live, wasn't it? Probably still had a little bit of food left on it. He probably would have liked to maybe have just stayed there. But God said, no, get out of here. We got other things to be about. And so he did. Noah did what he was told. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by their families from the ark. Now, there's a lot. Again, that took about a year and a couple, 2 or 3 weeks. But there's a lot of things that happened at this time, I think, that we ought to probably at least think about a little bit. First of all, the reshaping of the earth's crust would have happened in great extent by this flooding that was taking place there. Some of the crevices and canyons and things of that sort that we know today, like the Grand Canyon, for example, could have been cut during this time frame very easily. You know, people study that thing, they study the layers of sediment and all that stuff. Well, this thing's got to be about 4 million years old, something like that. No, it doesn't. That thing could have been cut in a matter of days with what was going on. And the sedimentary process is taking place. All this stuff churning and burying one thing on top of another and all that, you would have the formation of sediments very quickly with what was going on there. And so that doesn't really prove much of anything. We talked about the fact that it wasn't just like a rain that you know about. It didn't come from clouds. There were no clouds in the atmosphere yet. It came from that canopy, I think, that we talked about earlier. And Psalm 104 talks about the oceans going down and the mountains coming up. It looks like God made new ocean basins all over there at that time. Let me show you this picture again. This is in your deal or not. This is a picture of what, can you see that? Kind of have to look closely. That isn't real bright. Maybe I can get it just a tiny bit brighter. Just take it out of that sleeve. Yeah, ain't a lot better, but a little bit maybe. But you can kind of see how, where if there was originally one land mass, which appears to be the case, that's the way it was described to us in the creation week, and you break it up into what we have in the continents now, they look like they all fit back together in a jigsaw puzzle at one point in time, don't they? So it looks like what happened at the flood was that God fractured the crust of the earth into what we now know as the continents, and just kind of broke it into these pieces. And they were moved and drifted around into the different places like we have now. So that the whole earth's crust, see the red lines? The red lines are the boundaries of tectonic plates. That's pieces of the earth's crust that are fractured into these huge surface plates that are outlined there by the red line. This is kind of like what your skull is like when you're born. It isn't solid, it's in pieces, so that it can grow and move as your brain grows. It takes a couple of years and then it finally sets up and becomes solid. So your skull is made up of pieces that can move, bone pieces that can move. The earth's crust is made up of pieces that can move today. They're called tectonic plates, and you can see the different ones there. And it looks like what happened at the time of the flood is that God fractured the one mass of earth that we saw before into those different continents that we have now, and formed these different plates that you see here. Now here's the golden grabber of all of that. Every one of those plates wants to rotate counterclockwise. They're all trying to rotate counterclockwise, okay? Like this. So any two of them, look along the California coast there. The North American plate wants to do this. The Pacific plate that abuts it wants to do that, the same thing. So the border is, one is wanting to go down and the other is wanting to go up. So you have these shear forces along these tectonic plate boundaries that are wanting to move. They're wanting to scoot relative to one another. And scientists think that the San Andreas Fault down in Southern California has got about 30 feet of vertical slip stored in it. So that when it does indeed turn loose, those plates are going to shift relative to one another by at least 30 feet, they think. Well, what's that do to your infrastructure, your roads, your gas lines, your power lines, and all that stuff? Sewage lines? If one of them here is 30 feet removed from the other one all of a sudden. That's what happens in earthquakes. These plates shift a little bit. So the stability of the earth's crust after the flood looks like it's altogether different than it was before the flood. Before the flood, it looks like it was perfectly stable. There's only one landmass. But after the flood, when we have all these different plates that the different continents are on, and the entire Pacific Ocean sits on one plate. So you have this rim up here, the Pacific rim up the coast of the United States, down through Japan and into the Philippines and all that stuff over there. These are areas where there's high probability of earthquakes and volcanoes and all that kind of stuff. That's because these plates are always wanting to turn. They're spinning, trying to. But it looks like he took those plates and built it into what we have today. And so things are a lot different than they used to be. So if we're at all right or anywhere close to being right about the flood, things are much different than they were. Of course, fossil activity would be at an all-time high pace. You'd form, you need, fossils are generally formed by quick death, quick and buried death. Animals, plants, whatever the case may be, they die and they're buried right away. That's what forms fossils. Well, that would be happening at the flood for sure. And that last point down there, uniformitarianism, you know what that means? What that means is that all processes that you can observe on the earth today, decaying processes and things of that sort, they've all happened that way forever. Uniformitarianism. So if you have a process of decay going on the earth now, and you can see how that is going, you can predict back how old something is then, right? That's where they get these huge numbers. They say, well, wait a minute now. this thing is decaying at this rate, and we know it is such and such years old, so we'll just say that at the beginning of that, we'll project that back using that exact same rate, and that says how old it is. But it ain't true. The problem is that it isn't true because of what happened at the flood. Uniformitarianism isn't a solid theory because everything changed too drastically at the flood. So you can't use that to project backwards how old things are. That theory is undermined by the unique happening of the flood. So, where did dinosaurs go? Dinosaurs, warm-blooded or cold-blooded? They're cold-blooded. It means their body temperature becomes that of their surroundings. You're warm-blooded. Your body temperature pretty much stays the same no matter whether you're in a hot room or a cold room. A few degrees variation in your body temperature and you're in trouble. So it needs to stay stable. But cold-blooded critters like snakes and reptiles and that sort of stuff, their body temperature adapts to whatever environment they're in, and so if it's cold out, they get cold. Well, these guys probably coming off of the ark into a new environment which is altogether different than the warm, constant environment that they were in, they probably struggled to survive. They had to migrate from where they were down to warm climates relatively quickly. And on the way, they had to find lots of things to eat because these are big herbivores, and a lot of them probably just couldn't make it. I suspect a lot of them just died off because they couldn't adapt to their new environments and there wasn't enough food source quickly enough for them to survive. So I don't know that that's a fact, but I think that's a reasonable explanation for how a lot of those dinosaurs died off was just because of the change in the environment here on the earth as a result of the flood. So, after a year, God says, come on out and get on with living on this new environment, this new earth that you're now in. So they did. But the first thing Noah did in verse 20 of chapter 8 was he built an altar to the Lord as an act of worship. Noah is trying to say thanks, God, in the best way he knows how, and so he builds this altar. Where'd he get the wood? He had a big source of wood, didn't he? Quite a reserve of wood that he could take some of and use to make an altar. And he takes every clean animal and every clean bird and offered them offerings unto the Lord. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. What's that mean? Burning flesh smells good to somebody? No. It just means he's pleased with it. That's all it means. It has nothing to do with your olfactory nerve. It just means God was pleased with what Noah did. And so it's a soothing aroma to him when someone brings an offering that is acceptable to him and pleases him. So it's just a matter of acceptability. It's got nothing to do with odor. So the Lord says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. So the Lord makes a promise to Noah and his descendants there, and he blessed Noah, verse 12, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, that's new, isn't it? They didn't have cold and heat before. It's like living in Honolulu. No cold, no heat, 75 to 82 every day of the year. No variation. But now, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. So there will be order in the new environment, and God has promised that that order will remain. And it will involve the seasons, temperature variations that they didn't have before. All of that is new, but it is established by God, and it, again, undermines that principle of the uniformitarianism, which cannot be used to predict anything because of this abrupt change in things here at the flood. And God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Same command he gave Adam and Eve. I want you to occupy this place. Fill it up. It can sustain a lot of life. So get out there and populate this earth. And here's another change, verse 2 of chapter 9. The fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth, upon every bird of the sky, and everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. Everything, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give it all to you as I gave the green plant. So now, after the flood, the fear of man is installed into animals. Why is that? Because man can now eat the animals. So to kind of put some checks and balances in place, God puts the fear of man in them so the animals get out of there. They see man coming, they run. If he didn't do that, they'd be too easily wiped out by man as food. So there's a balance in the natural world that God has established here after the flood between animals and man so that man can't overrun them so easily. So he puts the fear of them into the animals. Now you can eat meat. Before, only fruit salads. Maybe an occasional rabbit food salad. But now, man, you can put some steaks on the grill after the flood. Only this, verse 4, you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. That is, you can eat meat, but do not eat the blood. Drain the blood from the meat before you eat it. Why? Because the blood was used as a symbol of God's atonement for man's sins. It was the replacement for man's punishment for his own sins. So he's not to consume that. It is always a prefiguring of the atoning work of Christ, the forgiving of our sins by the shedding of Christ's blood. So you can eat the meat. Do not eat the blood. There are some tribes around the world that still do, but they shouldn't. They shouldn't be doing that. And furthermore, in association with this life being represented by the blood, verse 5, and surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast, I will require it. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. That is, if somebody destroys human life, whether it be man or beast, God says, I want you to take that life. Now notice he doesn't say, hey, I've got a suggestion for you guys. Give this a whirl and see what you think about this. He says, hey, I require this principle of capital punishment. If an animal kills a person, you must kill the animal. If it has a propensity to kill people, you must, as people, kill that animal to protect yourself. If a man kills another man, you must likewise, as a race of people, you must take that person's life in order to protect yourself. I will require it from every man and from every man's brother. I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Again, notice, for it's in the image of God that he made him. What's happening here is that when man kills another man, he's in essence striking out against God because that man is in the image of God. And God says, I'm not going to tolerate that. For your own sake, as a race of people, you have to protect yourself against destruction from evil and in what we would call first-degree murder, intentional murder, not accidental necessarily. So the principle of capital punishment is established here with Noah and his descendants by God as the very first thing they did. Why? Well, what happened to the very first generation before the redo? You had Cain killing his own brother. God knew that the propensity of man to murder one another was there and was high, and it needed to be regulated. And so the very first thing he says is that, look, to protect the race of man, you've got to take this action. So capital punishment is instituted in Scripture not as a suggestion, but as a requirement for the race, for the sake of the race, to protect itself against evil destruction by its evil members. So that's why that was the first thing he did. But verse 7, as for you, be fruitful, multiply, populate the earth abundantly, and multiply in it. That was their job. Probably only handleable by Noah's sons and their wives, because apparently Noah never had another son. So he and his wife were apparently through. So this commandment has to be fulfilled by his sons and their wives. So then God spoke to Noah and his sons to him, saying, now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. Who is that? Who's Noah's descendants after him? Every swinging person that's ever lived is Noah's descendants and after him. This covenant is with mankind, with everybody on the planet. It has nothing to do with Israel or the Mosaic law or anything like that. It is with mankind that God enters this covenant and tells him to, first of all, institute capital punishment, and is promising some other things here, as we'll see. So everyone who descends after you, Noah, which is everyone, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds and cattle and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. And I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the earth, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. The promise that God is making Noah and mankind here, all of us, is that he will never destroy the earth again by flood. Universal flood like this. There may be local floods. Again, the people down in Houston could identify with a local flood, can't they? But not a universal flood destroying all of life like this one was. That's God's promise to us. And he said, this is a sign of the covenant which I'm making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. Here's God's signature on this deal. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come about that when I bring a cloud over the earth, cloud? What's a cloud? Well, they're going to learn. They didn't know yet, but they're going to learn. When I bring a cloud over the earth, the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I'll remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. What is a rainbow? Well, it's light being dispersed through water vapor in the atmosphere, like a prism, into different bands of frequencies that your eye can perceive as color. Right? Is that what it is? That's what it is. It's also God's signature on this covenant that he has made with you and everybody else, where he said, I won't ever do this again. And here's my reminder to you that I won't ever flood the earth again. I'm going to stick that rainbow in there, that prism of light that you can perceive. And I'm telling you, when you see that sucker, that's a reminder that I made you this promise. And if you don't ever understand it beyond its simple scientific terms, you're missing the point. It's the signature of God in the sky for you to see. Now, in order for it to occur, you've got to have some water vapor in the air, water droplets in the air, and that almost always occurs after a storm. I suppose it could occur before a storm, but it's usually after. So you'll probably see it after a storm has come through and there's a little water vapor left in the air. But it's God's telling mankind and reminding mankind that he made this promise to us. And he signed the promise with that rainbow. Now, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were these three guys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Let's don't get into that this morning. It's a little more lengthy than a little bit of time we got left. We want to talk about what happens next. Let's review what we talked about now. After 1,656 years of human history from Adam down to the time of the flood, the entire race of mankind has been so corrupted. Now, either it was done by angels cohabiting with women, which I don't happen to believe, or it was corrupted simply by virtue of those two lines of descent intermixing, which is what I think was the case. It was so thoroughly corrupted that God decided to destroy the whole earth. And there was only 8 people of all of the earth's population that were sufficiently righteous that God spared them, and He provided a protective environment for them. Looked just like this, only a little bigger. And the animal life. And for a year, they were protected in that ark. For 40 days and 40 nights, the earth was just hammered. It was crushed by water from within it and from above it at such a rate that you couldn't survive it. There was no practical way of surviving that kind of erosive pounding that the earth took for 40 days and 40 nights. And for 150 days, the water kept increasing on the earth to where the whole place was then covered. It was a ball of water. And Noah and his family were safe in the ark, and they came to rest on the mountains of Ararat there at about that time. And then for the rest of about a 1 year period of time, they stayed in the ark until it was safe then to disembark and to start rebuilding the earth. Massive, massive changes in the earth's contour, its topography, its crust, its hydrological cycle, its temperature variations. The polar caps probably froze within a few years of this new environment. There were no polar caps before. Now we have both North and South polar caps. They froze. Animals probably couldn't all survive. Many of them, I suppose, died off before they could migrate and find enough food to eat to survive. So a lot of the species probably ended there at the flood. And what we have now by way of order and cycling of the earth's characteristics is altogether different than what they had before. So don't try to understand what happened before the flood with what you know about after the flood. Different systems, different cycles, different things going on. And survive they did. And at the end of that year or so, God said, come on out of there and let's start the do-over. Just like happened with Adam and Eve, we're going to start populating the earth and going again, except now I want you to take care of yourself. You must institute the principle of capital punishment to protect the race of mankind, just like we saw happen before with Cain and Abel. If not, it can be a pretty short duration. And so things started over again. 1,657 years after Adam, it all started over again with those 8 people. And the populating of it was done by 6 people. Apparently, nothing's ever said about Noah and his wife ever having any more children. In fact, pretty sure they didn't. So it all started over again, and all of our ancestry is from one of those 3 guys, Shem, Ham, or Japheth. And certainly all of our ancestry is from Noah. But we'll talk a little about their lines of descent and what nations they populated and what happened afterwards next time. It's a little too lengthy for the little bit of time we have left. So any questions about the flood? Universal flood, worldwide, totally destructive of the earth, changed things drastically. Yeah, Mike?
With the flood, is it implicit that all sea creatures covered every inch of the earth?
I guess the sea creatures survived. Or at least most of them. Now, a lot of that breaking up of the earth's crust and the water coming from up below might have done something to their habitat. But I guess a lot of the sea creatures could survive that. Birds couldn't. They got knocked out of the sky because they had to be on the ark. And the animals on the surface of the earth had to be on the ark. But the sea life, I guess some of that probably survived. And some of it probably became extinct also. So there may be traces, fossilized traces of certain things in the oceans that we don't see anymore. The oceans are probably much more extensive than they were. More water on the earth now than there was back then, probably. The ocean basins and so on. So that they changed, I suspect. But I guess some of them did survive. Some of the animals in the ocean probably did survive. Yeah, Betty?
My Bible says in chapter 8, Noah then removed the covering from the ark. and saw that the surface of
the
bones was.
Yeah, apparently he has some kind of a little lid device of some kind there that he could take off and see out. I guess, I don't know if the covering was the entire 450 feet length of the ark or if it was just a little section that he could take off and open up, but I guess he had something like that. He couldn't open the door. Remember, that door is too monstrous for him by himself, it looks like. So I guess God had to open the door to get the animals off of the thing, just like he had to close it earlier. But he had some way of, it looks like maybe getting out, checking out and see what was going on. I don't know, man. That thing is that's a unique vessel in the history of mankind, isn't it? And to have four guys build it, even if it was 120 years, that's still a building project that's just monumental. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
This is kind of silly. I get my history so mixed up. Were there dinosaurs on the ark, or the dinosaurs were after or way before?
Apparently, the dinosaurs, since all of creation was in the 6 days, nothing was made afterwards. So all of the breeds of animals that was ever going to survive was on the ark. Now, as I say before, certain types of them probably struggled more to survive than others did because of the change of environment. So my thinking is that the flood could explain the extinction of the dinosaurs. I don't know for sure that that's what happened, but it makes sense that it did and could. Now remember, before the flood, for 1,650 years, they were all herbivores. T-Rexes weren't running around eating all the other dinosaurs. They were eating plants and stuff like everybody else. But they probably, a lot of them died off, I suspect, at that time. Some of the critters, like alligators, for example, you know, they think they're prehistoric in nature. They've maybe just survived right through there. If they were in the water, they didn't have to necessarily be on the ark. So there may be some sea life critters that just survived out in the oceans, even though all that upheaval was taking place all that time. The flood explains a lot of stuff if we understand some of these principles that we think were in place. We don't know for certain about any of this, but it makes sense. Mountain ranges were probably formed at that time, and as these plates were moved around and pushed together, you get the Himalayas and the Andes and the Rockies and all these big mountain ranges, you know, popping up and being smashed together and formed during that year. And maybe some of that went on for a little bit after that 1 year. I don't know. It all had to happen within the 1 year. Maybe not. I don't know. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I got you on OT, so I better let you go. We'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Have a good week.